Probably. Probably was. The RFPF probably never really went and actually did these things.
We did.
Reported that they did. But, you know, they went out and slept in the hammock somewhere or something. There were occasionally battles in the province, but, you know, some very remote outpost on the border of the province would get attacked. And my theory at the time was that there were some infiltration trails that cut through corners of the province. And the VC were just keeping the RFPF in their outposts away from these infiltration trails so that they could go down further south into 3 Corps and 4 Corps and just travel through.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all they wanted, was to keep people
moving through
from
looking. Just go right through the lot. Okay.
And lo and behold, one of the squads of this platoon ambushed and killed a courier who was traveling from one communist committee to another communist committee and had all this mail and, you know, records of tax receipts and all that kind of stuff in his pouch.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that would have been pretty interesting, but what really got my attention is he had an order in his pouch from the province military committee to some unit out in the jungle that he was traveling to that said that they were to blow up the house of a lieutenant
mm-hmm.
who was training a suspicious new platoon at the National Training Center and get rid of this guy because he was too dangerous to have around.
Yeah. Okay.
And so I moved.
Yes, okay. Out of the lottery?
No, I just changed houses. I moved to another place in town.
Did you move to the province house?
No, I never lived in the province house. Okay. I rented a house on my own on the economy. And that, I had a lot of friction with my province senior advisor over these activities. He thought I should eat in the sector house with the rest of the officers, not with these Australians and CIA people.
Mm-hmm.
I also spent almost all my off time with Vietnamese officers
mm-hmm.
In their homes, in bars, drinking with them, doing the things that they did. I mean,
these
I lived
special
their life.
Forces, the LLDB officers.
There were some of those. There were also a lot of the RFPF officers who were regular officers who were assigned to the province to those jobs, you know, and who hated
mm-hmm.
it, come from other parts in the army,
mm-hmm.
had been in combat units and wounded and were assigned there to convalesce, or who had political connections and used them to get this plush assignment, in which there were seldom any combat. And so I learned about how you buy your jobs
yeah.
and how the corruption system worked and who was whose uncle. And I met a lot of general officers, mistresses, who liked to come to the lot for the weather. And then I met the generals through the mistresses. And I lived a different kind of life. And the American colonel that I worked for thought all this was, you know, atrocious.
Yeah.
And, very lacking in appropriateness, etc.
You're going native and you're not just doing
a
straight military.
He gave me a zero on my performance review. It's the only time I ever got an... In fact, I'm the only person I ever heard of who got an absolute zero for a score.
So there was one success with this unit, and you, and then
they were
that was
sent
bit
away.
Of a revelation. Yeah,
right. And then they grad. So I got to know about, you know,
mm-hmm.
I got more interested in the political stuff that was going on, and who this province committee was, and how did they operate, and why could these people just go up and down these trails and nobody paying attention to them.
Right. Okay.
And I was learning a lot about corruptions and things like that. But then I decided to go to Saigon. And so my first assignment in Saigon, I looked at a lot of different jobs, and where I went was to the Vietnamese Command Center, and what the Vietnamese called the Joint General Staff.
Yeah.
It was a part of their J3. So I worked in their headquarters, which was a block or two away from the MACV headquarters, in their command center with them. And we were part of the MACV, what was called COC, Combat Operations Center. We were a division of that, but we were located over in the Vietnamese headquarters. And the main purpose of this group that was over there was to collect data about Vietnamese operations feed it to the U.S. MACB so it become a part of the reports that went weekly back to Washington.
Okay.
That was mainly what they were there for. But because I spoke Vietnamese and I sat next to the Vietnamese division chief's desk and overheard all his telephone conversations and everything else that was going on, I got involved in a lot of things beyond what was expected.
For instance?
Well, he would get involved in a conversation with some friend about this slot was open, but you'd have to pay this much money to get the job and things. And so when he hung up and things, I'd say, gee, is that job worth that? Why would anybody pay money for some job like that? And he'd say, well, because you can get this out of the job,
right,
you can keep this portion of the money, or you can sell the rights to log timber, or you could do this, or you could control the restaurants or whatever it was in the area. And the Vietnamese, the General Vinh was commander of the Joint General Staff in the Armed Forces, and these guys were his operations staff. And they traveled to every major Vietnamese battle. As soon as, you know, they got it, came in the morning, there was a report there had been a big battle during the night, they would dispatch a team of two or three people out there to find out firsthand what happened and come back and tell General Vinh. They placed no reliance on any official message. So they had to personally, some trusted person, had to personally go out there, talk to the commander, see what had happened, make an assessment, come back and tell General Vinh. And I went on every one of those trips with them. I was their American guy to go with them. So I went all over the country, I went to every unit, I met all the key commanders. Plus, socially, I was living on the economy. I was moving in Vietnamese social circles.
Does this mean that you had an income apart from your military income?
No, I just spent all my money.
Okay. Living on the economy seems to connote some sort of... As if you were investing in the economy.
Instead of living in a BOQ and eating in the U.S. officers' clubs, I rented a house in the Vietnamese economy and ate Vietnamese food and had Vietnamese servants and went to dinner with Vietnamese people all the time.
That's how more than one person I've interviewed who was on the Phoenix staff has described it. The guy who lived on the economy.
I never slept a night, I don't think, in the entire time after I was in Vietnam, a U.S. facility. 90.
And all this time, you're continually re-upping for new assignments in Vietnam, and that must have some...
Oh, yeah, that's another whole story. It got to be... The first one was simple. Second one was a little hard. The third one started to get nigh on impossible.
Mm-hmm.
I was on orders to go to the advanced infantry officers course in Fort Benning.
Mm-hmm.
I had to get them canceled. I had to get out of the assignment. I had to pull strings. I had to get people to help me to stay in country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it got more and more complicated all the time.
So you were getting involved with politics on all sorts of different levels.
Yeah. But, you know, the first, say, up till I was there 3 or 4 years, up through this assignment we're talking about in the J3, there were general officers who valued what I was doing, U.S. general officers, who I could always appeal to, get me one more extension, get me this or get that. And they would do that. Well, originally, the guy who was the 2-Corps senior advisor was General Metaxas. So he got me the assignment in Dalat. He endorsed my request to stay on in country and the value of that. I don't remember who the J3 was when I went to MACB headquarters to work in the Vietnamese headquarters. But he did the same thing. But you know, I always got a 1 or 2 or 3-star general to endorse my request to stay in country.
Mm-hmm.
They write a little statement about how it was militarily essential. And so for the first couple of years, the people, you know, back in officer personnel in Washington didn't say anything, just agreed to it. But each time it got harder.
Let me ask you another question. Did the CIA have anybody working with the JGS?
Not that I know of. Now, during this time that I was in the JGS, though, CIA came to me once or twice and said, you know, we're thinking about running an operation up in Thailand, or we want to set up a secret agent net, or we want to do this, or we want to do that. Would you be interested? So the first time this happened for us, I said, God, you know, who are these guys? How do you know who I am? Why are you coming to talk to me? I said, well, Peter Skov recommended you. And so I said, well, I'd be willing to find out about it. I remember the first one, well, they told me to come down to this building downtown Saigon. I thought this was all very exotic. You know, here I was, a 24, 25-year-old infantry captain, spent all his life out in troop units in the field, and I went into this civilian building. They were all wearing civilian clothes. They had women working in there as secretaries. I thought it was a different world, you know. Here I was in fatigues and parachute boots. And anyway, they wanted to do something with the Vietnamese refugees up in Thailand, northern Thailand. I agreed to do it. I agreed to go. But I don't know what happened. Somehow or other, it got squelched as an operation or something. It never got approved, and so I never went. But I guess from their perspective, now they had me on the hook.
Yep.
I had agreed to go. I had agreed to do things with them. I was someone who was interesting from their perspective.
Can you be a little bit more specific about who the they are?
No, I don't even remember.
Was it a
I don't think
person?
They ever told me who it was.
Was it intelligence people or paramilitary people? You know?
Oh, no, it was intelligence people. They wanted to set up a clandestine intelligence network in the Vietnamese refugee camps in northern Thailand. So they were, you know, they were agent handlers.
Okay.
This was down in the embassy proper. This wasn't in any of their cover offices in USAID or any of that kind of stuff.
Okay.
This is where the station people were. So, you know, I was continuing to learn more about Vietnam, learn more about people. And I got introduced to the guy who is what they call the chef de cabinet. It's kind of like an executive officer in the U.S. He handles these general personal affairs as well as the military affairs. And I got to know the chef de cabinet of J3, the chef de cabinet of General Vinh. And for some reason, I'm not sure what, a number of the ranger officers and a number of people who I knew a lot have moved over time into key positions in the administration. They had sort of all been in exile when I met them. You didn't get assigned to a ranger battalion because you were in good graces of the administration. They sent you out there hoping you wouldn't live through it. In fact, the battalion commander of the battalion, when I first went there, had spent a year and a half in jail as some kind of
assistant. CM thing?
Yeah. So, you know, they were rabble-rousers, people who were on the side of coups and revolutions and things like that. But at the time, I didn't know that. But later, these people all showed up in different positions. And, of course, I had a great bond with them. I had been in combat with them. I had shared the risk of death with them. I had been in brothels and bars with them. I had lived a life with them.
Yeah.
It was different.
Yeah.
And
you had to trust.
I spoke fluent Vietnamese. I was somebody from the old days when they were warriors, you know. Even though that was only 2 years ago and I was only 26 years old and they were now full colonels,
yeah,
this bond existed. And through them, I met many of their bosses who were, you know, very senior generals and in powerful positions across a wide spectrum of things. One of the people I met was a general who became the director of the National Police, General Phong. And he also later was Minister of Revolutionary Development. So, you know, now I'm sitting out there in the headquarters. I know all these people. I live on the economy. Somebody called me up one day. I don't know who it was anymore. And said, we're starting a new organization. And we'd like you to consider coming and joining us.
ISIS.
And so I went over there, and Evan J. Parker Jr. was the head of it. There was only maybe four or five people assigned to the office so far. And so I spent a couple hours talking to Evan J. Parker about what the hell they were trying to do. And
he explained about the infrastructure?
Yeah. He said, you know, we're interested in targeted operations against the civilian part of the Communist Party. That, you know, all these search and destroy operations, the main force warfare that's going on, everything doesn't address the real problem. The real problem is the shadow government. And I was ready for that. You know, psychologically, emotionally, everything I knew said, that's exactly right. That's what we're not doing that needs to be done. I'd had enough basic combat to sort of have that under my belt. You know, going back to a regular battalion didn't have any particular thrill in it. And here was something that I thought was really important, wasn't being done, and would be interesting. And so to get started, when I agreed to come, I was still a captain. They only had, I think they only had three military slots authorized in the office at that time. So I was double slotted against Colonel Emmer. He and I shared one slot.
Okay.
Until they got the organization on paper and organized.
So this is into 68.
Yeah, this is the fall, late summer maybe of 68, you know, after the Tet attacks were over. I was in JTS through the Tet attacks.
Okay.
General Fong was, I think, the J3. I was very involved in a lot of ways in the Tet attacks, the fighting in Cholon. I was down there all the time through that.
Were you? Yeah, let's backtrack.
That's how
you.
I met some of the police.
Okay. Can we talk about that? Where did you know Telly at Camp 4? Did you, you know, were you working with as an observer?
Yeah, what happened was in the initial Tet attacks, I didn't have much of a role. The VC, the NVA regiments, penetrated Tonsonute Airfield, cut off a lot of the part of the city, and I got isolated and was on the wrong side. Couldn't come to work. I was on the inside of the NVA controlled territory for 4 days or 5 days. I couldn't get out. I had to go through NVA lines to get back to the other side. And I didn't think that was a good idea. So I wandered around and stayed out of view. So by the time I got into the office, things started to be back under control, and so I didn't see much of the actual attacks or anything happening in the office. But one of the aftermaths of that was there was a lot of press coverage in the Vietnamese papers and in the U.S. papers about how the Vietnamese had not only been used one application of firepower in Cholon, but they had deliberately done it to destroy Chinese property.
Yeah.
Well, General Vinh was very upset by this, and he felt very strongly that what had happened was there had been careless use by regular military units of regular weapons in an urban area, which had caused the destruction. So he put out a lot of detailed instructions about the use of high-powered weapons, mortars, recoilless rifles, etc., in urban areas. So when the second Tet attacks started in May, he wanted to make sure this thing was controlled and policed. So he took, again, several trusted colonels out of his staff and sent them to Cholon to be his personal emissaries. And they had to rule on the use of anything bigger than a machine gun. And I went with them. So we accompanied all the frontline units block by block through the fighting in order to approve whether they could use a mortar or whether they could use a recoilless rifle or not, whether in our judgment it was warranted, or whether we could storm the building and take it with low loss of life with only rifles and hand grenades. No, we had to do that.
There's a very interesting episode that happens at that time when a bunch of keys political supporters get bombed by American Marine helicopter. Do you know what happened?
No, I don't know what happened because I was never with Americans.
Okay.
But I was personally involved in. There are these little meat cakes that are called pate show that are very popular in Vietnam, sort of a pastry wrapped around meat. And these two colonels and I met with Key's people on a corner and had a couple of cups of coffee and three or four of these pate shows for breakfast. And as we walked away from them is when the strafing began and they were all killed. And so I was like 300 feet from them and just spent an hour and a half with them before they were killed.
You didn't see the incident itself?
Yeah, I did.
You didn't. Did it look like accidental to you?
I thought it was accidental. You know, I have personally been bombarded by U.S. artillery. I have personally been on the receiving end of three U.S. airstrikes. I have been with Vietnamese units that U.S. pilots misidentified as VC and attacked. So, you know, to me at that point it was easy to believe it was an accident.
Yeah.
And that they got confused about where the front lines were and who was the enemy, and they strafed in the wrong place. The problem with these things is it's possible that someone could direct that to happen and direct that it be made to look like that. So if you're on the receiving end, how can you know what the truth of it is?
Yep, well, there's so many things.
But, you know, from any outward circumstantial things, there was no reason to, if you were on the ground, to believe that it wasn't an accident.
Does that have anything...
Now, if you're very political, and
yes,
you thought the U.S. would prefer not to have those guys around anymore and that they wanted to undercut and eliminate Key's supporters, that was a logical thing to do, was kill them.
Does this incident have anything to do with
military support? And the VC did release the POWs. I forgot whether it was four or five of them.
Do you have business association with Savaggio?
No, but I see him from time to time. He lives in Reston. And, you know, maybe once or twice a year I bump into him someplace in a shopping center usually. Or on the street. We travel back and forth on the same road. He lives a little further out than I do, and every now and then, you know.
You see him on his bicycle?
No, he doesn't drive a bike anymore.
Oh, okay.
But we're stuck in traffic or something, and I look around, and he's in the car next to me, you know, and we're sort of side by side, and we haven't seen each other in 6 months or something. So we have a few words as to, you know, what are you doing now, what's going on. I believe he's in HEW.
Northrop.
Oh, is he? He works for Northrop.
Oh, yeah. He's the head of their Asian operation.
Oh, really? Last time I saw him, he was he spent a long time on loan from the Army to HEW to deal with refugee affairs and Asian resettlement and things like that. And the last time I saw him, he had gone to work full-time as an HEW employee doing the same thing.
No.
Well, I didn't know he'd left there.
Yeah, very busy.
You mean he markets airplanes to Asia?
I don't know exactly what he does.
What the hell does he know about airplanes?
Well, tell me a little bit about your introduction to the, and I assume that when you say National Police, you mean Special Branch of the National Police?
Well, General Fong became the Director General of the National Police in Kodo.
Right.
And I was a pretty close friend of his at that time.
So then it's...
And when we set up ISEX, that was to work with the Special Branch. And when we first set up ISEX, as I said, you know, there were only a few people in the office, and there were only three military officers. And the Special Branch set up a separate building in the National Police compound to be the Fungwang, as they called it, to be the Fungwang Central Office. And then they detailed mostly Special Branch policemen to work there. But there were a few military officers, Vietnamese, and a few regular National Police also to round out the staff. And there were a couple of CIA advisors and myself who were detailed from the small cadre that was setting up the ISEX office to be the people who worked with the Vietnamese.
Would one of them have been a fellow named Joe Sartiano?
Yep.
Do you stay in touch with him?
I don't stay in touch with
him. Oh, that's right. Okay. Well, I've been having a hard time getting in touch with Sartiano.
Yeah. I assume he's retired.
I talked with his brother, and he's out in California, out west somewhere.
He was one of them.
And he, I assume, was already there when you arrived.
About the same time. You know, the office was only 2 months old or 6 weeks old or something like that. I don't remember exactly what sequence people were assigned to it. But Joe was the senior CIA guy who was down in the Fungwang Central Office. And I was down there from the operations section of the Phoenix office. Might have been one other person.
A guy named Robert Haynes, by any chance? Very rugged, big-looking guy. I mean, the toughest-looking guy I think I'd ever seen in my life.
Well, he was there, but I don't remember whether he was down in that office at that time or whether he was back in the other office. The other office was set up in USAID 2,
yeah,
which was a compound for Americans. And I don't remember whether Bob was down in Vietnamese headquarters with us in the very initial stage.
But there were perhaps, you say, four of you? You and maybe...
There weren't that many. There were maybe two or three. I can't remember now whether it was a third person there or not. Seems to me there was a third person, but I can't remember who it was.
You remember a guy named William Law? He was, I believe, the first operations chief and was replaced by a fellow named George French.
Oh, George.
Who I have talked to.
Well, maybe Inman worked for Law.
Inman worked for French.
For French?
Yeah, and came after
Law was there.
ISEX starts in the summer of 1967. That's when it began. And Sartiano and Parker and a few
I guess that's
guys
right.
from the military.
I remember now when I was in JGS a couple of times going out to, you know, these teams that I talked about where there were battles.
Yeah.
And there were these guys out in the field. Said they were ISEX advisors who were military intelligence officers.
Yeah.
I guess that's right.
And what do your and in that sense then is Joe Sartiano your boss on the spot down
he
there at Special Branch headquarters? What kind of guy was he?
show was, I guess, a classical CIA operative of his era. He was a first, I believe, I'm pretty sure he was a first generation Italian immigrant. Mm-hmm. Grew up speaking Italian and English. He was drafted when World War II started. And this is his story anyway. Yeah. And, you know, he was going through basic training center, and they called out a bunch of them one day and said they wanted to introduce him to somebody. Inducted in the military, and the civilian came in and said they were looking for foreign language specialists. And all these people who had been called out had either as a native language or a second language from childhood another capability. Of course, Joe spoke Italian. And wanted to know if they would go to work in some type of activity that would use their language. Joe thought the training was crummy and was horrible, and he didn't like what he was doing. He said, shit, if I go someplace and talk Italian, that's probably a good deal. They didn't tell him any more than that what it was.
OSS.
So it turned out he was in OSS. And if I remember correctly, what they needed them for was the preparation for the Anzio invasion. And so they went in as teams in the initial assault, to immediately meet with the locals and tell them, you know, that this was a friendly invasion and they should support the invading troops, and Hitler's days were over, and to develop civil government in Anzio and Sicily to immediately fill in behind the advancing troops and set up the local government. And then he had a long career in Italy with, you know, the Italian political parties and all the political action kinds of operations that the CIA ran in Italy, you know, where they funded different parties or they supported different candidates or they helped the labor unions or they did this or they did this, all covert.
Classically, yeah, right.
All the classic political action.
They were very much funding socialist left groups against the communists.
Right.
And
Joe was in the thick of all that for many years as a, you know, guy who had been on the ground as a part of the liberating forces. Like everybody else who came from the CIA during those days to Vietnam, he knew nothing about Asia. He knew nothing about that brand of communism. He knew nothing about the culture, the politics, the language. He suddenly got reassigned because they needed more people in Vietnam. And he didn't know what the hell he was there for, or what he was supposed to do, or how he could help them, because he didn't understand any of it. Somehow or other, you know, almost magically, his great in-depth CIA clandestine background was supposed to be help, and something that he could teach the Vietnamese that would help them.
Did it?
No, they weren't really running clandestine operations of the type that he was accustomed to. But, you know, Joe, like the other senior people, had a certain amount of managerial talent, a certain amount of knowledge about how bureaucracies work, how to organize an office. And those were the things that they really helped the Vietnamese with, how to set up their office and how to get, you know, it organized into different branches. Things they needed, like, why don't you write an SOP about what's supposed to happen?
And that was your job,
that
right?
That was my job.
Okay.
Why don't you organize what they call dossiers, which were files, one for each VC, and file each intelligence report in it. And each district operation center should do that, and there should be a province operation center as well to coordinate the districts. You know, the basic structure of the program was what those guys brought to bear on the problem, to get it organized and to try to manage it. Not so much the trade craft and the clandestine aspect, which had been their life before.
Okay. Here's a question for you. I have interviewed Evan Parker, and he said when he started up Isaacs back there in 67. One of his jobs was to sell it to the chief CIA guy who was liaison to the special branch, the Beale operations, right out of USAID to a guy named Dave West. And West wasn't going to buy it because he said special branch was already doing what Phoenix was going out to do. And for as long as special branch had been around, their job had been going after the VCI. He couldn't see the need for another organization to do it. Was there that conflict going on?
Well, there certainly was a conflict. West didn't want to share any of his prerogatives with yet another powerful CIA guy.
Be a part. Yeah.
Or right. Anybody else.
Or
who
anybody
came. You know, he had his thing. Why should it be, why should there be two things working with the special branch? It wasn't proposed that this be under his control. It was proposed that it be separate and that it interact with the special branch on a separate basis, and that separate special branch officers would be assigned over there to do that.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't have any control or influence over it.
Was it something that was, that became a flaw in the program? Because did there become a split of Phoenix special branch people and CIA special branch people?
But I don't think it was a flaw in the program. What I think is, first of all, about his argument that it wasn't necessary, that's just pure bullshit. The problem was, from my perspective, sure, the special branch was supposed to be doing that. The special branch was supposed to be carrying out internal surveillance and operations against subversives. That's the purpose of a special branch anywhere. You know, there's lots of police forces in Europe that have special branches. And that's their basic role. The problem was, I would say, from my perspective, you know, over the years of working with them, knowing what was going on, the vast majority of the special branch energy went into surveilling, reporting upon, and thwarting opposition political parties, non-communist. Let me put it that way.
Mm-hmm. And let the military handle the enemy? Was that the
philosophy?
Yeah,
you know, every now and then they did something about a VC, particularly if he was in Saigon. But they didn't have any systematic program against the communists. They now and then arrested one, but their main activity was to keep the existing regime in power.
Yeah.
And the political threat to the existing regime was not the Communist Party.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Communist Party was outlawed, it couldn't vote, etc. Yeah. What police were doing was keeping under control was the loyal, so-called loyal opposition.
Yes. Okay.
Okay, so, you know, keeping track of what Trần Văn Bông was doing, or what Kuomintang was doing, or what the Vietnam Quốc Đảng was doing, was what they were really spending their time and effort on.
Okay. So, could it be then that Phoenix becomes an anti-communist element of the special branch, or does Phoenix simply start doing the same thing?
At an absolute minimum, Phoenix caused a focus to be brought to bear on anti-communist activities.
Okay.
The other thing, of course, the special branch was very involved in corruption, which also occupied a lot of their time. I mean, here you have a very corrupt environment, a very corrupt a culture that tolerates corruption to a vast extent.
I understand about pre-vandalism and how.
And now you're going to run covert activities in it.
Yes.
So, you know, it's ready-made for that kind of problem. And the special branch was also, you know, very active in the sect kinds of things, you know. The Wahao and the Cao Dai, all those people, as well as the formal political parties that were in opposition. So when we come on the scene, TU in power later, they're part of his operation.
Okay, now.
So they're not mainly focused on the Communist Party.
As I understand it, Loy Nguyen Tan was Premier Kim's man that started up was assigned as the principal person for the Phoenix Special Branch. Is that accurate? Would Sartiano have been working then with Tan and then him giving you assignments to work then with other people, perhaps subordinate to Tan?
Well, yes, except but because I was fluent in Vietnamese, Sartiano didn't speak to him in Vietnamese. It was a triangular relationship.
With Tan. Sartiano and yourself.
I mean, and all the other branch chiefs, all of Tan's key subordinates and Tan himself.
Can you tell me who some of those was? Cao Minh Thiep one?
Yeah. And there was a special branch policeman who headed one of the branches. His name escapes me.
Who? H-U-U?
Yes, who? I guess he was a police colonel.
I think, yeah.
Tan was a Vietnamese military officer.
Right.
And was assigned to the special branch, which was also, you know, not something that they liked a lot. Yeah, you had that kind of tension. You had the police were controlled by the military as well as the provinces and the districts. And there were regular policemen, and then there were military officers who were assigned to the police.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the director general of the national police was not a police officer. He was a general.
Yeah.
Not a police general, but a military general.
I understand, yeah.
So it was all that. But naturally, you know, in the beginning, since Colonel Tan was a military general, there was a natural affinity. So where did I come from? What did I do?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I worked with the military. Do you know so-and-so? Do you know so-and-so? We knew people in common. I spoke Vietnamese. I had spent 4 years with the Vietnamese military. So there was an immediate rapport between us.
Well, what kind of guy did you find Tan to be?
I haven't thought about him in years. For myself,
mm-hmm.
I found him to be a very friendly guy.
Yep.
Very easy to talk to. I traveled extensively through Vietnam with him.
Setting up DIOCs and PIOCs and all that.
And all the inspection teams, we went out on inspections together. He was not, from an American point of view, he was not demanding. You know, we would go to operations center at province or district level, and he would have a discussion with the chief a bit while his Vietnamese subordinate and I poured through the dossiers and looked at their procedures and talked to them about what operations had they run recently and what they were doing. And a lot of it was a sham. A lot of it was a facade that they were meeting the letter of the law. So they had 100 dossiers, but 75 folders had nothing in them. And 15 of the other 25 had a couple of newspaper clippings from the local paper about the VC district chief. You know, they had no real intelligence. They had no real targeted operations that they were setting up or running or collecting intelligence in order to do. And he would never, Tan now, you know, when we had the report, he would never crack down on them or lean on them in some way that was acceptable to us, you know, from the West. Now, in Vietnamese, he would make a few remarks to them, like, you know, gee, everything here isn't what it should be,
mm-hmm.
and you really ought to try to do better.
Mm-hmm.
And when he came back, he would file a report with his superiors that this place was not in very good shape.
Yeah.
But he didn't say, you know, damn it, I'm going to be back here 3 weeks from now, and you better have this thing rolling, and you better have some real information here.
Is this a cultural face-saving thing?
It is.
Basically.
And that's why it's difficult to say, you know, was he effective in his own culture?
Yeah.
That's hard to judge. But from a Westerner's point of view,
mm-hmm.
he was not demanding.
Was Sartiano also there to bridge the gap between, for instance,